Hey everyone, this is Adriana, producer of The Skill Set. I just wanted to let you know that a new episode of The Skill Set is live, and you can listen anywhere you download your podcast. This new episode is with Solomon Renfro, a talented sneaker designer at New Balance, who shares his unique journey from studying interior architecture to becoming a footwear visionary. You don't want to miss this conversation.
Lydia, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay, I can do that. I am the lead content strategist for Imagine a Place, and I have been a part of the OFS Imagine a Place ecosystem for more than 7 years. So listening to the podcast and everything that you've been doing. And so I'm very happy to be here and share some of the insights that I've been learning.
Awesome. Well, it's so fun to bring team members, teammates onto the podcast and hear their perspective. So you had this awesome idea of putting together a Women's History Month episode by pulling some of the best stories that we've had from our female guests. And there's so many, but we've got 6 or 7 for you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was very hard to pick because there are over 60 episodes that we have with women, probably more. And so, yeah, we're very excited to highlight these amazing women. Just a few. We wish we could highlight them all, but yeah, very excited to share things we've learned.
Awesome. Let's play it.
Let's do it.
I was born in Vietnam, right after the fall of Saigon, and my family was a refugee family. We escaped after the fall of Saigon because my dad fought on the American side in the war. And after the communists took over, they had this long list of names of people that they would punish that fought against them. My dad was on that list. And his punishment was that his children would not have an education. And my dad was a school teacher before he fought in the war, and he really valued education and opportunities. So he spent a year compiling and designing an escape out of the country, which, you know, I didn't even learn about until I was in college. My parents didn't even share this story with me.
Wow.
What I learned was that he basically put together a boat that was a fruit boat. And for an entire year, he spent the time sailing along the Mekong River to see where all the communist stations were, to understand the best way, the best route to escape. Meanwhile, he's selling watermelon on top of this little boat. And in the process, he took some engine parts from air conditioning units and rigged his own little engine on this boat. And the night of the escape, my parents said that, you know, at that time, you can't tell anybody of your plan. You can't tell your parents. You can't even imply that this is happening because you don't know who is a spy. So my mom told me this heartbreaking story where every night her mom would crawl under the mosquito net and put socks on all of our feet to keep us warm. And the night of the escape, her mom came into the room and she could feel her hands looking for her feet and putting socks on my sister's and my feet and her feet. And she was just holding back the tears because she knew that she might not ever see her mom again and she couldn't say goodbye. So,
oh my gosh.
I mean, so heartbreaking. They went on the boat, or our family went on the boat. They had to give my sister and I cough medicine so we would sleep through this and not cry. And when we got to the entrance of the Mekong River, out into the ocean, there was a new communist station that was formed that my dad didn't know about. And he chose a night of no moon, so it was pitch black. And he heard them say, "Stop, we see you, come back, turn around, you're caught." So he turned on the engine, which, you know, is a diesel engine, which is quite loud. And they actually had spotted a different boat that was escaping next to us that he didn't see.
Wow.
But once he turned on his engines, they spotted both of us and they ran, they came after both of us. They caught the one next to us. But since my dad had rigged these extra engines, we were able to outrun the communist boat and were able to go out into the ocean. And we were there for 3 days and ended up in Malaysia, where a lot of refugee boats had been going over to shore, but the government were directing them over to this island that they called Refugee Island. And my dad knew that we would be part of a list of thousands of names. And so he capsized the boat and we swam ashore with literally nothing on our backs, but our clothes. And they were forced to take us ashore. And he said that there happened to be this abandoned building that used to be a retirement home that the local government let us take refuge in. And for 8 months, he said he would go door to door and just ask for anything, you know, bananas, whatever anybody had. And he said that was such a special moment because people had nothing and yet they still gave whatever they could. And it might have been time to help us, you know, make a shelter. It could have been bananas or newspapers or whatever. But he taught me early on in life that the less you have, the more you should be giving, or the more you're conscious of giving, because you know what suffering feels like and you don't want others to feel that way. And so it's always important to help others. And after 8 months, the Red Cross had caught wind of our family taking refuge in this area, and we were lucky enough to be sponsored to Seattle from an Episcopalian church with a bunch of Vietnamese people that wanted to help out a family, and they chose our family. So that's how we came to America. And I came when I was two. My first childhood memory was coming to Seattle Tacoma Airport and seeing really bright lights and a lot of Vietnamese people making a fuss of us. We came, my parents worked two jobs. I hardly ever saw them because they were trying to learn English and just trying to do however many odd jobs that they could just to survive. And we are so grateful for the help of the church. They helped set us up with low-income housing and, you know, setting us up in schools and everything. And my childhood memory is a lot of us just trying to adapt to this new environment. And I find it really ironic, fast forward 40 something years, I came to America as a boat person, and now I'm designing high-end luxury cruise ships.
Oh my God, I mean,
boat is still there in my life. But yeah, here I am.
So home for me as a child was a little bit traumatic, and I grew up in an abusive home. I was one of seven kids, and my mom and dad were incredibly overwhelmed, and there was even a lot of neglect that was happening. And so I found myself often kind of left to my own devices and imagination, and wanting and longing for just a little tiny corner of order in my world to control something, because everything else was always seemingly out of control. And so there kind of became this awareness and connection with nature. We would go to California every year. My mom would take all seven kids on the Amtrak train to go see her parents. And we basically spent 3 months of the entire year in California, which was a lot. And so I sort of left all of the things that were traumatic or painful, and spent these like glorious summers frolicking in the hills and foothills of California, and Pebble Beach and Big Sur and Carmel, and which is where they lived. And my grandpa was a painter, and I was exposed to art, and he created, you know, woodwork pieces, and he had this workshop. And I mean, it was like this treasure box that opened my heart and my mind to what was possible. And so, yes, there was trauma, but there was also this like glorious playground as a little girl for me to go escape to. And that wildly impacted my view and perspective of interior design. And it's kind of like woven in the fabric of everything that I do today.
Wow. I mean, that, I can't imagine what that would be like, that summer away, and then that eventually ends. You come back.
It was hard.
That,
I can't imagine.
It was a real difficult challenge. And then over the years, I would start to see something, another shift happen. And I started seeing my mom work to create, it's like finally she got past like all the babies weren't tiny itty bitty babies. And we were starting to get just a little bit bigger. And you could see that, you know, she was trying to create the sense of home for the first time. And she would put up wallpaper herself, or she would paint over the brick fireplace, or she would, you know, work to make the yard lovely and all these little things. And it wasn't extravagant. It certainly wasn't expensive. We were completely broke, but I could see my mom work hard to try to bring this little sense of home and beauty into our lives. And that meant everything to me. And that also really impacted my journey.
Now, you were not the oldest of seven, but you were one of the oldest, right? I mean, you were the second oldest. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I mean, how did you help your siblings, and how was your relationship with your siblings?
I love that question, because growing up with siblings was one of the most impactful journeys of my life. We were almost all a year apart, if you can believe that. And so at one point, my mom had six teenagers in the house all at one time. And there was never food, just a lot of kids, because you couldn't keep a gallon of milk. But, you know, we became each other's best friends. We survived some trauma together and all sorts of things. And we sort of linked arms. Now, don't get me wrong. We absolutely fought like cats and dogs. I mean, every other day we were trying to kill each other. But there was definitely this deep, you know, this deep bond that was forming. And as the second oldest, I looked at my siblings as like the little chicklets, and I was the mother hen, like the second, because I could see my mom was drowning. The youngest of the seven kids was born mentally disabled and handicapped. And it was like, just, there was no time, not even anything, to just invest in us. Rightfully so. She was overwhelmed and didn't know what to do. She had no resources, and she's trying to keep together this little family. My dad's a workaholic at this point in our lives. He was incredibly abusive. I mean, it was an unhealthy environment. And so I looked at my siblings, and it was a beautiful distraction for me to be able to like sort of rescue them, sow into their lives, be very motherly. And, you know, and it was from that I always knew I wanted to, you know, a giant family. I thought I was going to have 10 kids. I only wound up with five, which is plenty. the sibling dynamic really impacted my life.
I'm not afraid to put myself out there or take risks or challenges. You know, I came into a very male-dominated industry myself. I didn't really have any female managers. And what really made me was, I said, I'm going to be the first female leader in this group, basically. I'm going to show that you can organically grow. And I think just what made me was every hurdle that came up, by just, you know, sometimes you have to take a little bit of a quiet moment, you know, have a little cry maybe, you know, get over yourself and then move on. And there were so many scenarios like that.
You just seem like you've got it all together, right? I mean, you've climbed mountains, you've ran marathons, or a marathon, right? And you stepped in to an all-male firm, and you know you wanted to be that first female leader, and you went and did it. Hmm. Like, where's the struggle? Like, what was your childhood like? Did you ever struggle?
Do you know what? I think that's where it comes from. I think I saw my family. They bought a house during quite a similar time, really, where the interest rates were very low, and then they raised so much, my family lost everything.
Oh no.
Like they had to go bankrupt. And then my dad went into this job. He's in like the construction industry. He went into this job where he was working for not a very nice boss, you know, very micromanagey, very, and that's just not my dad, like, at all. And one day he just quit. He's like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to do something on my own. So being a young woman and seeing my dad lose everything, be treated the way he was, and then actually lay everything down and go, I'm going to do it myself. And he did. We weren't ever given anything. And I think as I was growing up, it was a real life lesson. As soon as I could work, I didn't just have one job. I had three.
Wow.
Because I was just like, well, what's next next in my line, okay, what's next is I want to buy a car. So I'll make the money to get a car or the lessons. Okay, what's next? You know, so it's all of these like little goals that when I saw my dad achieve them, I was like, I don't ever want to be in that position. You know, I learned a lot from him, but it was such a hard time that as I grow up and have my own family one day, I want them to learn that, and they're not getting it, you know, getting it easy from me,
right,
you know, because I never had it easy. So I think that's a huge life lesson that if you want something, you have to put your all into it, you know, and that is your heart, your soul, passion and energy. And there are some real tough days, and there have been in my career, you know, there are times where I was like, I can't do this. But you think back to, why am I doing this? What makes me tick? You know, what's in there that keeps me going? And I look at that a lot with the people that I hire as well. I say to them, you know, this is a tough job. You know, you get let down all the time, you know, in this job and in life, you know. So what's going to make you stay around? Because I'm going to invest a lot of time and energy into you. What's going to keep you here? And I kind of need to hear something, you know, that makes me go, oof, yeah, you got it's in here.
I was driving in my car listening to Brené Brown's Braving the Wilderness. And it was during a really difficult time where my mom was really sick. My mom had stage 4 cancer for a decade. So I was a third of my life by the end of it. And she was, you know, she was a single mom. She was my rock. And so Brené was citing the work of Julian Holt Lundstedt, who is a seminal loneliness researcher, but also now a colleague and a friend. So basically what she talks about is how we are hardwired to be in connection. We evolved to be in connection. The headline is always, loneliness is worse for your health than smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Wow. Right? Like, that's huge. Yeah. So, and that comes out of Julian Holt Lundstedt's work, and she's an amazing researcher out of Brigham Young. And so I think for me, I was just like, and the built environment is part of this. Like the, like I've seen so many times in my own life, it sort of framed the ways that, you know, when my mom was first diagnosed, how I used third places like coffee shops to be in community with others so that I wasn't all alone. But I also was sort of going through my own process. So part of connection is talking with and having those deep connections. But part of it is just like a lot of what we lost during COVID, which is the sort of micro connections that let you know that you're safe and well and a part of a community of people that you see regularly. And that sort of familiarity grounds us. And so in my TED Talk, it was the first time I'd ever talked about my mom publicly and our struggles, and specifically when she passed away. So so you'll have to like bear with me. I was 4 months pregnant. I was in the middle of architecture exams for anyone that knows what that's like. I had a looming clock. I was working on a giant project. There were all of these things. And there's really no space or time to feel that like overwhelming cascade of grief. And so when my daughter was born, I mean, I was basically like, okay, I have like a 99% chance of like severe postpartum depression. And I really tried to be like, all right, what can I do proactively to try to address this? And so I rallied family to try and be like, okay, if I essentially go catatonic, I need people to be here. But more than anything, like as a researcher and an architect, I knew the power of walking and of being around others and of feeling that connection. And so every morning I would strap my little baby girl to my chest. It was cold January. And we would just walk and walk and walk. And we would walk to the, I'm very fortunate where I live. We can walk to the grocery store, can walk to cafes and to the park. And through that experience, I was really supported by my community, not in the way that a lot of times people think of, like, oh, and then you talk to all these people and you became best friends with them. It was really like, I just needed to know that I was like safe and okay, and me and my baby would be okay. And, you know, the grocer that just would always smile and ask how we were doing and, like, you know, share his stories. Just the other moms and babies at the coffee shops. And you would just be like, okay, I'm not alone.
When I was young, there are two pivotal things I think that happened in my life. The first one is that, you know, I'm from a Commonwealth state in the South, Virginia, and my brother made a youthful indiscretion that resulted in him being incarcerated for 15 years, right? And it started my family on this journey of going in and out of prison facilities. And for me personally, I just remember feeling like, yo, this shit is so just inadequate, demeaning. It was all the things. And I couldn't quantify those with the big 25 cent words at 14, but I felt it in my soul from the inside out. And my family would have to deal with that for a very long time. And year over year, one, I would stop thinking about how it felt for me and how all the other people who were coming in and out of this space, and most of them who looked like me, from the children going to see their loved ones, to the spouses, to the parents, to the guards, right? And it just sat with me. And fast forward, you know, I go to college for something, to be a dancer and a ballet dancer. And then I don't get financial aid. And I say, I'm going to join the military. And so military could pay for my school and what no one knew was going to happen. I got to my first duty station in August. And then a month later, September 11th happened. And I was on my first of five deployments to the Middle East. And wow. I was 19. I had never been out of the country. I'd never really been away from my family. And I needed some solace. Frankly, I needed some privacy to cry because I was batshit scared. And I didn't have it, right? So I was in this tent with about 14 other women. And I took some sheets and I hung it around my cot. And I made three sheet walls. And that was the first space I ever created. Huh. And I bawled like a baby for 15 minutes. And it was something about how that space healed me. It brought me solace. It brought me comfort. And I would do that four more times in different extreme environments. So when I got out of the military, I was like, I want to do this thing where I create spaces for people. And that's how I found my purpose in interior design. Is that fair?
That's not only fair, that's amazing. Courage.
No.
Wow. And
why? Tell me. Okay. Tell me why it's amazing.
Well, I think first, not a lot of people have been in that situation. And I guess where maybe you feel like you have no control.
Mm-hmm.
And you found a way to bring some control into that moment and then take that with you and then allow you to do that for other people. I mean, I think that's amazing.
This is why I asked that question, because is it amazing, or is it just how life guides you? As it connects that to what I do now as an interior designer, right? What Determined by Design's mission is. If I strip down the dramatic storytelling piece that I so just as eloquently do, what I literally just said was, I had to go in prisons and to war to realize my space fucking mattered. Why wasn't it in my community? Why wasn't it in the affordable housing community that I grew up in? Why wasn't it in the after school program? Why wasn't it when I walked into the corner store? Why wasn't I walking into spaces in my community that made me feel something? Even though I couldn't describe it, I could feel it. I could feel this just like solace, comfort, healing. And I don't think we don't realize Black and brown people are not being met with elevated, and that's a key word, elevated spaces in their own damn communities. That's where what I do comes in. I don't want people to have to go to war and go in and out of prisons. I don't want them to experience it that way. That's how it connects back to, I think, my why. I don't want you to have to do it the way I did it. Mm. Is that fair?
I was doing a building for a client in another city here in Mexico. And I was doing the building, the architecture completely, and the interior design. And I was going there every 2 weeks because it was pretty far away from the city. And I spent there 2 days going around site and making changes and giving my opinion and doing everything. And almost when the building was finished, I found out that all the workers in there thought that I was the client's daughter that was giving only my opinion and that they needed to follow my instruction because I was the daughter of the client. They never thought I was the architect. And I was like, what? Why did you thought that? Did you think that? And they were like, because we never thought you were the architect. I mean, you're young, you're a woman, and no. We thought that that other guy that was an engineer in there was the designer and the architect, and you were only here giving us your opinion, and that's it. And I was like, no, okay, no, this cannot happen. I mean,
yeah, I could see them. Boy, the client's daughter knows a lot about architecture.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, what are you thinking?
Oh my gosh.
It has happened a lot.
So how do you coach young designers around you to best handle that situation?
I always tell them that they need to be loyal to themselves, that they don't have to change the way they think, or they have to really defend their thoughts and their knowledge, and that they never have to be afraid to show it. Because sometimes when as a woman, you start giving your opinion and you start like pushing some things, they really, the perception of a woman that's always giving her opinion, it's like, I don't know how the word and how to say it in English, but that it's too pushy or that it's too manly, or I don't know, many descriptions that can happen. And I always say to them that they don't have to be afraid to say and defend what's on their mind. That probably they're going to have to work harder than men. That's not fair, but sometimes it is what it is. But they don't have to be afraid to do it. And that the rewards and the satisfaction that you're going to have when they really start listening to you, everybody, coworkers, clients, and everybody, it's going to be really satisfying. And that they need to explore, but that they don't need to prove anything to anybody. One thing is to say what's on your mind, to defend what you think and what you think it's right. And another completely different thing is that you have to prove something. And you don't have to prove anything to anybody but yourself. And if you're with people that they're constantly asking you to prove yourself and to prove your knowledge and to prove everything to them, then you're not in the right place.
It has played a role for a long time. I think much less so now that I'm not so secretive about it and so ashamed of it. I think that those early neural pathways carve a deep, deep path in your brain, and it takes a long time to sort of smooth them over. I do think that I'm much more capable now of integrating them into sort of daily life. They're not a constant, there's not a constant struggle. I think it's more just a sort of underlying worthiness issue that I still grapple with. But again, much, 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 much better than it was. And for anybody that's listening that isn't fully aware, and I sense that Doug might be a little bit tentative about asking, I suffered quite a lot of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse as I was growing up for many, many years. And this was the 70s, and it was not nearly as widely known that this was happening to people, young people. And at the time, I thought I was the only person in the world that was happening to, because it was so foreign to me. The whole idea of what was happening just didn't make any sense to me. I'd never heard about it before. And I really did think I was the only person in the world that it was happening to. And my stepfather told me if I told anybody, he would kill my brother and my mother. He had been a butcher and formerly a fighter, a boxer in Germany, where he was born. Between all of his knives as a butcher and all of his ability to fight that I witnessed and saw, I really believed him. And so for many, many years, I didn't tell anybody and just sort of disassociated for those years. I mean, I know from other practitioners, other psychological practitioners that I've spoken to, that certain traumas give people a hyper-awareness of others, and that as you're growing up, and if you're in the midst of a lot of traumatic experiences, you become hyper-aware in an effort to protect yourself or to be able to assess any situation, to understand your level of danger. And I think that is one thing that I did get from that, which was a hyper-awareness of how people are feeling or what they're experiencing. And that's definitely something that I use in my life now all the time, sometimes to my detriment, but mostly not. I have a very good read on situations, a very, very strong pattern recognition. So certain things I was able to take from those. And then, of course, the most sort of fulfilling aspect of that experience now is working to eradicate sexual violence. And the work I do with the Joyful Heart Foundation, the work I do with Mariska Hargitay, that has really become a lot of the ways in which I've been able to rethink how I think about these things and what I can do to help others.
I've been doing a lot of reflection of myself, and some of the things I'm like, is this just a trait of me, you know, me as Crystal, or is this something that has been programmed, like we were talking about earlier, like has it been programmed into me to really like not complain? I guess that's the correct word to use. It's just, I'm not going to complain. I'm just going to do what I got to do. Like, I might not sleep, but I'm not going to, and it might be physically overwhelming, but I'm going to get it done. And, you know, then you also see, I've never felt comfortable saying, I don't want to work on that project. And I know that some people have done that, or even saying I do, like, advocate for myself to oversee a project too. And so both on both sides, like, I, that communication and feeling comfortable enough to, even though I have a great relationship with, you know, my coworkers and my bosses, like, sometimes I don't feel comfortable doing those things. And so I don't, again, is that just me as a personality, or is that something that is like really buried deep down into like who I am? I'm sure you've heard the study of saying that like white men will go into a job knowing that they can do like 50% of the work, but they'll figure out the other 50% and they'll still apply for that job. versus women, even being a woman, like you will say, okay, I can do 99%, but that one thing I can't do, so I shouldn't even apply for the job. Like, is that just, you know, again, being a woman of color, like those are things that I'm still navigating and working through to see, like, what are those?
So, wow, great to kind of go back into memory lane.
Yes.
And hear some of the stories that gave me goosebumps or mm-hmm. made me rethink things. Mm-hmm. Which one did you connect with the most?
I think for me personally, I connected with Ginger Curtis a lot, just because I immediately could sense, oh man, I look up to her, even though I don't know her. And I think that that's one of the amazing things about the podcast. It gives you a window into these leaders' lives. And as a woman in the industry, I just feel honored to then learn from them. Her humility and confidence, when I think about the themes of all of these, that was just something that really stood out to me, was just that I think as a woman, sometimes you're thinking, oh, I can always do better. I can always push myself more. Oh, couldn't I have done a better job at that? And I think I saw that in so many of these stories of couldn't I have done more? Can't I do more? Always striving for more. And then, but then also having this inner confidence that at the end of it, you're like, yes, I can push on. I have accomplished something, and I'm going to persevere.
You know, the word persevere there, it's interesting. Like when we started down the path of this idea, mm-hmm. I don't think either one of us had a plan Mm-mm. for the theme of overcoming or
yeah.
the theme of having a moment of hardship.
Yeah.
But it just so happened that some of the stories that really stuck in our minds
yeah.
were stories about overcoming.
No, definitely. I mean, it was hard to, when we started this journey, I just started listening back through the podcasts, and then, you know, we're trying to pick who do we feature? But yeah, that's a very prevalent theme. And I think every single one of these women is a leader today because they took the trials, whether it's through family, whether it's through sickness, you know, work obstacles, they took those, and instead of letting them just sit in that trauma or the struggles, they said, no, I'm going to use this to shape me into a strength. It's going to shape these different elements. I'm going to be stronger because of it. It's going to, you know, I think of Debbie Millman. It makes me able to understand my audience. I'm more perceptive of them because of this. And so instead of it just being a weakness, what you've overcome and what we've experienced is part of what makes us who we are. And yeah. I think that's something that speaks to more than, you know, even just more than women. So even if there was a guy out here thinking, oh, this podcast isn't for me. No, this podcast is for everybody too, because we all have something to learn from this.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. And, you know, you mentioned humility
yeah.
earlier. And I thought what was interesting too is this wasn't the story about a hero. Like mm-hmm. none of these were. In many cases, they involved community, right?
Yeah.
This was about leaning into your siblings, leaning mm-hmm. into the community
yeah.
that surrounds you.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true.
There was a theme.
Yeah.
Around the role of place.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a deeper meaning. You know,
yeah.
Kia had an epiphany.
Yeah.
You know, Ginger talking about her mom taking place
yeah.
to a new level. Aaron's reflections on place. It mm-hmm. felt really like mm-hmm. place was a part of their story.
Yeah. No, every single one of them. Yeah, I definitely was thinking more specifically of Kia's, you know, just her creating that space out of nothing and then realizing the power that space had. And I think that that's also a very unique part of the story and a unique role that women in interior design play, right? It's like we get the power to curate a space that's safe for somebody. You know, ultimately, interior designers are shaping the future of other people who are then looking for that safe space to process so that they can move forward and overcome together. So yeah, definitely that's another great theme.
Yeah, I do love that place was like a place was a way to nurture.
Mm-hmm.
Place was a way to like grow and
yep.
and help mm-hmm. others. And I thought that was really cool too.
Yeah. No, yeah, sanctuary. That's what I keep thinking about. And,
oh, yeah.
and it brings me back to Lisa Kahn's episode, which is not in here. I'm going to give her an honorable mention.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but sanctuary also just being, we're creating a sanctuary space. You know, the interior designers are creating a sanctuary space for all those that will come after.
So you do an awesome job helping to kind of curate our content, think differently about what we're producing. Mm-hmm. How would you love the audience to engage in the podcast differently? Is there a way that you want to source more content or create things with the audience?
Yeah, I think I've been thinking a lot about this, actually. You know, we've got things coming. I'm not going to reveal it, but I've been thinking a lot about how do we help the audience tap into these insights, right? Because when you bucket content, when you bring it together, suddenly it's not just an individual piece. Suddenly you can see these themes. And so actually that's why I like this episode so much, is because it's like we get to sit here and just sit with a few episodes and consider, what are all of these amazing women and leaders saying? And what can we draw from that? These women have, you know, have had humility. They've had the ability to overcome, you know, the power of place in healing and restoration, learning how to advocate for yourself, right? Like how, you know, these are themes that we're seeing. And so when I think about the content and how I would want listeners to engage with the podcast, it's how can we thread the needle to say, what's the bigger story that we're discovering from all of these small stories that are being revealed to us? You know, these people are taking the time to share their insights and their thoughts on the podcast. Oh, what's the bigger takeaway? What's the bigger story that's being told about our industry, about each other, through all of that?
I love that. I love that. It's like if you could bring it all together, yeah. You know, that's the challenge. Now we have 150 something conversations that we need to bring our arms around and start.
We're
to
building
form.
A tapestry, right? And what's the overall picture that we're seeing? You know, I want to be able to go in and dig and pull it all out. And I think that's the challenge for us, is how do we build that tapestry so other people can tap into it at any moment? And this is one try of, this is an attempt.
So yeah, if you've heard all the episodes or even just half the episodes, wow, you've really stuck with us. Yeah. Thank you. But even if you haven't, if this is number 4 for you or 5 for you, we hope to make it easier to go find those. Mm-hmm. Find the ones that will really sink in for you.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Lyd, it was really cool to have you on. We'll have to do it again.
Yeah, let's do it again sometime.
For more design stories, visit us at ofs.com/imagineaplace. From OFS, I'm Doug Shapiro. Thanks for listening.